Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's August 8th, 2014. You are listening to the best PokerCast on the interwebs. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
Hey, Scott. I got a question for you.
All right.
Where are you?
You know, I absolutely have no idea ever.
Where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? I think that's what
I'm
we need to...
somewhere.
It's a segment.
I wake up every morning and I look out the window. I'm like, okay, maybe that's California.
That's what we need to do, a segment on the show. Where in the world is Scott Long? And then you have to give, like, clues to, like, tell us where you are, and then, you know, people can guess as they go along. I mean, you are just always on the road, man.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I tell you, people ask me all the time, does it get tired traveling as much as you, Scott? I'm like, no, it doesn't, except for, you know, you've stayed in a couple hotels, right?
Yeah.
What is with all these 47 decorative pillows that they put on the bed every morning and that little placard that tries to get you to spend $27 on a croissant and orange juice? Does anybody need these?
The pillows or their placard?
Both. So every afternoon I come back, my room's freshly clean, it looks beautiful. I knock the crap out of those onto the floor so I can sleep, right?
Yeah.
And every morning they're right back there.
Yeah.
Got to do it all over again. It's a battle of wills, I'm telling you.
That's called high class, man.
Yeah, it is, I know.
But, yeah, it's beautiful.
But other than that, I don't mind. I don't mind being on the road, and I definitely don't mind being on the road when I'm out here at Thunder Valley Casino Resort out here in California. We're in the midst of our world championship, and I got to tell you, Chris, it's very humbling being out here because this event is just blowing the doors off this place. Everybody here at Thunder Valley is excited about it. Obviously, Andy Huff's excited about it. Players are loving it. I got in town late Saturday night. I kind of wandered through the poker room on the way to my checking in the hotel, and I looked up at the board to see how many entries they had for the event too, and I saw like 430 something, and I'm like, all right, that's a good start.
Yeah.
And I woke up the next morning, went down and talked to one of the floor bosses, and he's like, ah, Scott, that was just the last flight. 836. We've never had a bigger tournament ever in the history of our resort.
Yes. That is awesome.
And I'm like, oh, my gosh. And he's like, yeah, we had 400 for the first opening event, 125 buy-in, Facebook, Twitter kind of thing they did. It's the middle of the week. Obviously, middle of the week, the fields were a little lower, but still crushing the guarantees. Last night's tournament, 260, 70 people, something like that. So it's really great. And, you know, I'm always happy when the property's happy. I'm always happy when we're happy. But I'm always happiest when the players are coming up to me and saying, hey, man, this is a great event. Or, you know, there's some people that I recognize from our world championship last year in the Dominican. They're Florida players, right? I saw them, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, what are you guys doing? You didn't come out just for this. And they're like, yes, absolutely. I'm like, oh, my gosh. So,
that's awesome.
You know, so players are really enjoying the structures, how the room is run, and people are traveling for it. So, yeah, it's been a fun week out here, and that certainly makes it easier to be away from the wife.
Have you done any research on cloning?
That's a good point. I could work on that.
Yeah, I'm curious if we could possibly clone Ben Irwin and his staff and then put them all around the country for us so we can do this for all of our tour events and everyone would just, you know, be like, wow, Ante Up, and like bow down, and that'd be awesome. Get on that, will you?
Oh, man. Well, I'll tell you, they've really come a long way out here. And folks that have listened to our show back from the beginning the first time we started talking about Thunder Valley was a couple years ago. And they had never done any tournaments at all here other than just the $30 daily kind of things that most casinos do.
Right.
And to see where it's come now, the room's increased to 30-some tables now. And our Northern California ambassador, Garrett, and I were talking to Ben last night, and it was funny because he was talking about, you know, the room's going to have to – it's going to get so big they're going to have to move it somewhere, and they don't know where that is right now. But he talked about a couple of years ago they were going to enclose it in glass.
Yeah.
You know, to keep the slot noise and the cigarette smoke out. And they ended up not doing it for whatever reason. And he's like, that was the best decision ever, because now he's added 10, 12 tables since.
Yeah.
As they do out here. And it really would have pigeonholed them in. So it's really good to see those kind of problems. You know, when you're growing so big, you got to figure out where to move it to. And rather than the opposite, when you're a 60 table room and every time you go, we go to visit, it's a 30 table room and then a 15 table room, table room, which happens more than I'd like to admit. But
I know.
But we'll tell you more about this next week. On next week's show, because we have a lot more tournaments coming up. But I want to have a little fun here at the beginning of this show, because I know we're going to have a lot to talk about next week, too. So, obviously, when I come out to this event, this is the only time I get to play the Poker Cruises and the Annie of Poker Tour events, right?
Right.
Went to the horse tournament and was super confident and played really well, and then, you know, So I finished 17th. So it wasn't the win that I had a couple years ago here, but I felt like I played really well. But I had this one funny, really nice gentleman to my left, older gentleman, regular here. So there was a hand where he limped, and I had something like 6-4 or something in the big blind, right? So I get to see a free flop and hold him. And the flop came 4-4x. And bet, call, raise.
Right.
At the end, turned over the hands, and I scoop it with all my 3-4s. He turns over pocket aces. And, of course, everybody does the same thing you always do in that case. Oh! And then, you know, once everybody goes, oh, somebody realizes, like, hey, you didn't raise pre-flop. And he's like, nope. Well, I was either trying to win some chips or lose some chips in that hand. And I wasn't trying to be a jerk, but I'm like, well, you succeeded in losing some hands in that chip. Mission accomplished. Oh, man, I love that.
That's pretty funny. At first, I thought...
That was my strategy.
At first, I thought it was a high hand thing or something, why he was doing that, you know, but just sounded like he just didn't play it right.
No. All right, and then one more story before we move on the show. But I was playing in the bounty event two nights ago, and early in the tournament, one round around, dealers dealing cards, and you know how sometimes they get a little excited and the cards kind of fly different places.
Yeah.
And so he wanted to move the card from, like, let's say the 5 seat to the 4 seat to give him his card. Well, the 4 seat kind of flipped out. Hey, how do you know that's the right card? He said. And they were like, I'm pretty sure. I don't know for sure. And he's like, well, I want you to call the floor because I want to be sure that that's my card. So, yeah, so he's from the Chris Cosenza School of Destiny here, right? He's got to have his card. He can't have any random card, even though the guy hasn't even looked at the card.
Hey, I dropped out of that school.
Okay, all right.
Sort of.
Former student of it.
All right, former student.
All right, so this kind of sets you up with this guy's life.
Right.
And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I'm just saying, you know, we're in the middle of a $130 tournament. This guy's concerned about which card he gets, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit later, the dealer starts dealing, and the guy looks up. He's like, hey, kill that guy's hand to the C2.
Right.
C2's sitting there. What'd I do? And he's like, he wasn't in the seat when the deal started. And the guy was like, oh, I've been here the whole time. And he's arguing. He's like, oh, wait a minute. It's seat one that wasn't there. I'm sorry. God. So he totally got these two guys confused, right? And this is the new TDA rule that some players hate, where if you're not in your seat when the first card peels off from the dealer, then your hand is dead rather than the last card, which is what it used to be, right?
Yep.
So the whole time he's arguing about this, guy in a tent seat, it's like, dude, what's with being Mr. Rules Enforcer here? What's going on? And the guy's like, well, they're always calling it on me. And then the guy in the 10th seat, deadpan, or 9th seat, whatever it was, deadpan, well, quit getting up. Old table bust out, and I'm like, it's so right. I mean, it just drives me crazy that people get upset about this rule when the solution to it is just keep your butt in the seat.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
I was at the TDA meeting when they came up with this rule, and this is the whole reason, is now everybody that plays poker has ADD. They got to get, I got to see what the sports score is over on ESPN. I got to track down the cocktail waitress and get a coffee because I can't wait for her to come. Or I got to go over to the other table and see my buddy how he's doing. No, you don't. You're there to play poker. Sit down, play poker.
Remember the good old days when people were only distracted by making bets on horse races?
Exactly.
Yeah. Now they're distracted by everything.
Would love to go back to that now. You know, because here's the thing: if you want to, you know, if you want to be sure you always have a cup of piping hot coffee in front of you, become a cocktail waitress. Then you don't have to worry about it, right?
I believe the term is cocktail server now.
Okay, all right. Well, you know, if you want to know what the sports score is, get a job as an advocate clerk at your local newspaper. You want to know what your buddy's doing at table 7, become a Poker News live tournament reporter. If you want to play poker, sit your butt in the seat and play poker. Oh, I'm tired of this, and I'm tired of people freaking out about it. And then they go, oh, they called on me. No, just sit down and play poker. Can we just do that?
What if you have to go to the bathroom? If you want to do that, be a bathroom attendant?
Well, if you're going to complain about it, yes.
Collect your dollars.
All right,
in
all right, rant over. I just,
all
you know,
right.
Poker folks out there.
But this isn't the only trip that you've made recently. That's the thing, is that you were also, while I was in Italy, you were traveling all throughout the South, weren't you?
Yeah, so and we're still backed up on shows with The Binge, which was my idea, I know, but that was great. And so a little bit behind on this, but I did a little sales trip to the South because, you know, we have a great Danny of Cruz coming up out of Galveston, Texas, October 19th. Great seats still available. Go to DannyofCruz.com.
Great seats.
And so I was doing a little sales trip through there. So I just wanted to update some folks on what I've seen. This is my first time in Shreveport. You know, when we did that crazy trip, you and I, we never made it up to Shreveport. We just, you know, there's only so much we could pack in that trip, right?
That's right, yeah.
So it's my first time visiting El Dorado and Horseshoe Bossier City, now that I know how to pronounce it correctly.
Yep.
Nice places, had good meetings there, and obviously that they just attract all kinds of Texas traffic up there being there. Enjoyed finally visiting there. Then from there I went down to Mississippi, started up in Tunica, and all the way down and around. And first thing I got to say, it was so sad to go to Tunica this time. And I know you've been there with me, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it's been so long since I put this in the show notes, I can't remember. But I remember, I believe when we were there last, there were 5 poker rooms there.
Yep.
Now they're down to 2.
Jeez.
And one of them left was always the smallest room in town. So there's essentially one room and then a small room off, you know, away from the strip area. And just so sad to see.
Yeah.
I was talking to some a couple of our listeners that came on the cruise, right? And they were talking about the Binge episodes and how much they miss having Faso on the show and all the crazy travels that Faso and I used to do. And I was like, you know, hey, the first poker trip that Faso and I took together was to Tunica. We went up there for the whatever the big WPT is. They had their World Poker Open, I think it was.
Right.
And I remember walking in the ballroom in there and just being mesmerized. This was before I ever went to the series and saw, you know, what the reel looks like. And it was just acres and acres of poker tables. And now that tournament's gone. They're still doing some big tournaments, but nothing on that scale. And it's just so weird to see an entire market just collapse like that.
Yeah, it's really sad. And I remember, too, when they had the flooding a few years ago. You know, that's like set this all in motion, it feels like. You know, even though I know it's probably not it, but it just felt like from that moment on, it's never been good news up there.
Well, when I was telling some people, too, I mean, this is a lot like what's going on in Atlantic City, because, you know, Atlantic City, a lot of poker rooms are closed, and a lot of casinos are closing there, and it's, you know, it's economics. It's not so much the economy that we're living in now. It's where these casinos are. I mean, Tunica, there was nothing there before they built the casinos. Churches and cotton fields.
Yeah.
And they added casinos, and it was churches, cotton fields, and casinos.
That's right.
And when they built it, there wasn't anywhere else to go gamble. You know, so it became this huge mid-country market. I mean, same thing with Atlantic City. Once Atlantic City opened up, now everybody didn't have to go to Vegas. They could go to Atlantic City. And Mississippi was next. And now that there's a casino literally within 2 hours of almost every American, people don't get on planes and fly to places anymore. Or they don't have to, right?
Yeah.
So you don't have to go to some place like Tunica to play. So, or Atlantic City for that matter. And that's why they're kind of correcting naturally in the market rather than anything that the market necessarily is doing. But nonetheless, so much history there, and it was too bad to see that. But on the good news, there's lots of other good news going on elsewhere in Mississippi. Obviously the Horseshoe in Tunica has picked up all the business, that the Gold Strike, when they closed, and, their new room is fantastic. They got those little USB charger stations at the table. doing some really good tournaments. So it doesn't seem on the outside that they're doing the whole Monopoly thing there. They're really trying to put out a really good product and give people that are still playing there a good game, which is good to see. And then the Hollywood property, which you and I played in, I believe, last mm-hmm. time up.
Yeah.
They moved it to the high limit area, or it used to be the high limit area, so it's a nice enclosed room now. So the two properties left there are investing heavily in their poker, which is good to see. So
yeah,
that was nice. And then down in Biloxi, the Gold Nugget, what used to be the Isle is now the Gold Nugget. Now it's finally completed their whole renovation. The poker room is gorgeous there. It looks just like Gold Nugget in Vegas. So people have been there, very well appointed, and they're doing some really interesting stuff there. I swung by Hollywood Bay St. Louis. That room is new as well, too. I moved from, you know, you'd get back in that corner. Remember that?
Yeah,
there.
Yeah.
Now it's out in a more open area. In Biloxi also, there's some talk that Harrah's Gulf Coast now might bring back a poker room. That was the first poker room I ever played in up there. And everybody loved that room back when it was there before all the other rooms opened up.
Is that when you lived in Pensacola?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
When I'm in Pensacola, I used to go over there all the time, but I didn't start playing poker until I moved down St. Pete and started talking to you guys. But Harrah's Gold Coast is where I finished third in that tournament and used the money to buy my mailbox.
Oh, that's right. Love that story.
Yeah. And Boomtown Biloxi, there's some talk about opening a poker room there, but I think since I made that trip, I've heard that those plans are on hold. So, so people are doing some new stuff there. And then I got to say the biggest thing is up at Pearl River. It's the only casino in Indiana. It's right smack dab in the middle. Had a great meeting there. They're doing all kinds of renovations, the entire casino, moving the poker room over to another the other side, and it's going to be really fantastic. And had a great meeting with the manager there. And so look for all that to be finished around January, I think he said, and that's going to be a place worth going to, or worth traveling to. Obviously, it's a place worth going to right now.
Right.
Worth traveling. And then I finished traveling back to southern Louisiana, got back to Baton Rouge, my first look at L'Auberge, and there's a L'Auberge in Lake Charles, too, which I popped in. Really, really, really nice properties, gorgeous, and it's good to see them on the market there. And then also in Lake Charles, a new Gold Nugget's opening later this year. So yin and yang here. You know, there's for every poker room that's closing in Tunica, there's a poker room opening somewhere else in the south or another poker room getting bigger. So at the end of the day, you know, if we're not losing tables in poker or we're adding tables in poker, that's a good thing overall. You know, even if some people lose their favorite rooms or things like that. So it was an interesting trip.
Did you go the same route that we went, essentially, or did you do something?
Kind of in reverse. I flew into Houston and used Houston to drive up to Shreveport, up into Little Rock, down to Tunica, and did that circle. Rather than, I think, when you and I went, we kind of flew into, like, New Orleans and went in reverse. But
yeah.
But yeah, plenty of back roads, if that's why you're asking.
I remember the roads, and we would see all these parishes, and I'd be like, what? What's a parish? And you're like, well, it's kind of like a county or, you know, I'm like, I have no idea. I didn't even know what a parish was. So shows you how globetrotter I am, you know. But, well, speaking of globes, global gaming giant Amaya has bought PokerStars/Full Tilt. And what many say is a precursor to Stars and Full Tilt no longer being labeled a bad actor. So it can re-enter the U.S. online poker market. Now, we know the story is older because we obviously have been doing the binging thing, and we were on the cruise and everything, but this is pretty huge news, I think. I mean, I realize that's why we didn't lead with it, though, because it's older news, but this is what it was going to take. You know, I felt like PokerStars could have kept throwing money at people and states and trying, but this really was, I think, the only way, and it's a brilliant move, I think, if it works out for Amaya. I mean, it's a lot of money. It was like $4.9 billion, essentially $5 billion. It's a huge, huge acquisition. But this is a game changer right here, especially since they've lined up with all of those rooms in California. And California must have known something was coming, you know, to do this. They must have been saying something like, hey, you know, you guys are going to want to do this because we're moving on soon or something. This is just huge. And I think it's going to be the thing that pushes it over now. And the feds are going to get involved real soon, I think, if it ends up being that they can clear the bad actor, bad name, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and the point that Maya's making is, hey, we weren't involved with this company back when it did whatever you say it did. I mean, our company has been clean from the beginning, so check us out. And it's because we're acquiring this brand doesn't mean we're acquiring its baggage.
That's right.
Or shouldn't acquire its baggage. So, you know, let us compete. And it's absolutely brilliant. I think it's going to be a good purchase for Maya. I'm certainly not – I don't think the PokerStars founders are shedding a tear at all. I mean, obviously, you know, at some point we hope that somebody will come in and give $5 billion to buy Annie up, and I will cry because it's my baby, but I will be crying on my yacht and not worrying about it, right? So I would like to think that these guys, even though they're out of the company now, are pretty proud of what they built because, you know, let's be honest, I mean, it was the best company, online company out there that they built. You know, aside from the golf ball things that they got caught on, everything else about the company was really solid.
Yeah.
And they should be proud of what they built, and obviously they got paid handsomely for it. So I'm sure they would have loved to stay with it and get it through. But, yeah, you know, just like you said, I think everybody see the writing on the wall. It was going to be a very expensive, very long fight to shed this bad actor. It's almost like wearing a scarlet letter around,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And this was the way to do it. So it'll be interesting to see. Obviously, there's lots of people that don't want to see PokerStars back in the U.S., and the bad actor was their easy way out. So now that seems to be gone, I think it's going to be a little bit harder for them. But you know, if you don't want PokerStars in this country, I guarantee you they're going to come up with some reason to try to keep them out. So the fight's not over yet, but it's certainly made harder for the opponents.
Do you think it's going to come down to something as trite as changing the name? You know, I mean, like, because...
Well, yeah, I mean, that would certainly solve that problem, but then that causes another problem, you know, because right now all the players know how strong the PokerStars brand is.
And yeah.
When you think about getting your money back, you know, those of us that had money on PokerStars had our money back, what, a month after Black Friday at worst, and people that had money on Full Tilt, you know, just got it back 17 years later, right?
Yeah.
But of course, then PokerStars bought Full Tilt. So, you know, it's just like this kind of like this Russian nesting egg thing going on here. But yeah, I think it would be a bad move to shed that brand until maybe they find that they're forced to. But
yeah, that's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that they're going to hold out as long as possible. That's the biggest brand in poker. But if they had to do it to get in the U.S., they would. I think they would. So, you know, to get past this stupid thing that, yeah, I mean, I can understand their reasoning for bad actor, but I think it's pretty obvious now that the owners have nothing to do with any of that, and everybody who's in place has nothing to do with that. They can't hold them back anymore. There's no reason why they shouldn't be able to land their deals now and do what they want to do. So it should be an exciting time, I think, in the next 6 months to a year to see what's going to happen.
Absolutely.
Okay, so each week we spotlight a listener who called our hotline at 206-338-6344. Or email us at podcast@annieupmagazine.com. And if they haven't won something from us in the past year, just like we do with Call the Floor and Hand of the Week, we send them something fantastic. This week's sponsor is J Design Playing Cards, the official playing cards of Annie Up. Check out J Design's great cards and more at classicplayingcards.com. Comes from our ambassador, Mike Young. Had the pleasure of playing with him all week on our cruise. Met his wife. His wife was very, very nice. And she's into astronomy, so she's going to be helping me out, I think, with some stuff. So I'm very excited about that.
Does she know where the Big Dipper is?
I think she does. I think she does. And so, she, you know, when we were playing, I was, like, folding my hands so I could talk to her. You know, oh, yeah, so this is the equipment you need for this and that. And so she's really smart. And just like Mike, Mike's really smart, too. Except when it comes to this hand. So let's see what happens here. He says, when online poker was in its heyday, there was a column about playing the computer hand, Queen 7, in certain circumstances. I did a quick search for it, but couldn't find what I was really looking for. Okay, I'm going to stop right here and say I did a search too, and all I found were, hey, the nickname for Queen 7 is computer hand. I couldn't find what he wanted either. So it's not going to be any deep, you know, hey, I found the article, here you go, and a link to it, because I couldn't find exactly what he wanted either. But I think I know what he's asking here. So he says, I essentially won a tourney playing it yesterday. We went to the final table and had about 300,000. I had about 300,000 in chips. Blinds were 8K, 4K with a 1K ante. Under the gun raised 20,000. I had Queen 7 and called. Small blind shoved for 88,000. The end of the gun folded. I remember the sort of circumstance where you're supposed to play Queen 7. He says, but I decided I would rather make the call and be wrong than fold and be right. So he called. Small blind had 9-9, and he flopped a queen, and now he has more than 400,000 chips. Ends up chopping the tournament for $1,700. Hoo-hoo. So here's the deal. I don't understand the call. I don't mind the first call. I don't mind the other call because you've got all that money in there, and you know you're going up just against this one guy who's in a blind who's kind of desperate. That's fine. You're getting the right, probably the right odds there.
Well, but the first raise was from the under the gun.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. The first call I don't get. Why did he call the under the gun?
Well, no, the under the gun was the first raise.
Oh, he was. I'm essentially thinking. Oh,
yeah. So he entered the pot with queen seven under the gun plus two.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Why did we call that? I can see why he calls the small blind. I don't understand why he calls the under the gun.
Yeah.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, the first call. I don't get it. I don't get the first call with queen seven. An under the gun guy raises to, you know, 3x, and you call with queen seven. I don't get that. That's the part I don't understand. There's no reason to call with that hand. Now, if you were in the big blind and the small blind shove and there was that kind of money in there, you might want to consider something like that. But even then, you have the under the gun behind you to act after that, and he could shove, and then you're like, whoa, I'm committed with queen seven? This is terrible. Now, in this case, since you already made that first, what I would consider poor play, it's okay to make that second call because there's so much money in there and whatever.
Heads up with 60, what, 68K more, or to put back in to win.
Yeah, to win 20, 108 plus your 20, so 128, and then the blinds, so the other blind. So, I mean, you're looking at, and the ante, so yeah, you're looking at like 150 or so. So that I think that's okay. Even then, though, what were you doing calling with queen seven in the middle of that? Because you're in middle position or whatever. I mean, that's under the gun plus whatever. So, to me, I can't imagine making that call there. No matter what they say about queen seven.
Right, yeah. So I totally agree with you there. I'm curious. I'm trying not to try and say Mike is wrong here, but I'm really curious whether this column exists.
Yeah.
Now, admittedly, I'm terrible at math and poker. Everybody knows that, right? So obviously somebody probably did some kind of analysis out there. So this column probably does exist. I'd be curious to read it if somebody could find it to figure out what this is. Because I always told them my understanding of queen seven is kind of that mid-range hand, right? So that's kind of, to some degree, why I would make that second call is because, you know, you're beating half the hands and you're losing the half the hands, and you throw in how much money you've already invested, how much you can win to make sense at that point. It's not like he made this move with deuce tray, right?
Right.
But for this to be a quantifiable play that someone actually ran the numbers on and said, you know, hey, once it's raised and re-raised, then you have to call a queen seven. I would love to see the math on that if it exists. And I'm not being jokey. I actually do want to see the math on it and see, because that is not something I would normally do.
No, in all the books
that I
have
no bracelets to my name, so.
No, I know, and neither do I. So this is all with a grain of salt. But in all the books that I've read way back when, and I really can't remember, there were situations where they said, okay, if you're in this position and this kind of thing happens and you're getting this kind of payback on your money, you can call with as weak of a hand as X, and maybe queen seven was the hand they inserted there. I seem to remember Lee Jones, Long Limit Hold'em, mentioning queen seven or something in one of his chapters, but I don't know if that, it wasn't a column, so clearly that's not what he was talking about. But, and then I think it might have been Sklansky too, might have said something about queen seven and Long Limit Hold'em or something. But again, I really think it's more of those, you're in a tournament and, you know, you're doing the range kind of thing, and you're thinking about, even if it might have been a sit-and-go thing where you push with as weak as queen seven, that kind of thing. But to call an under-the-gun raise with queen seven like that, under the gun, and you're that far into the tournament, I don't know I've never seen anyone ever say that's a good move. I've never, ever read that or heard it.
Well, in his defense, he never said that was part of the good move.
But. No, I know, but he said in the beginning, he's like, there were circumstances when you call with queen seven or when you play it. And so he called with it. So I think he's thinking that he was supposed to call there. It's what it feels like. Maybe he means the last part. Yeah, I don't know.
He made that point after the small blind shove. So I mean, the bottom line is it all worked out for him, because what he did is he got himself pot committed against the short stack. And had a call and hit the queen and won the tournament. But think about it in reverse, we'd be having the same discussion if he didn't hit this queen seven.
Yeah.
Or he folded the queen seven ahead of time. I mean, that's, you know, again, we're turning this question into a hand of the week at that point. But but really, it's almost like he created the situation that he ended up responding to.
Yes.
The situation being created for him.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's the difference.
It's like fulfilling a prophecy, that self-fulfilling. You know, you've already created this situation so that you can say, I did the right thing later, but you made the wrong thing to set up the right thing. You know, it's
exactly. Kind
of, 'cause in the beginning of the letter, he says that, you know, I remember there was a comment about playing in certain situations. That's why I was confused. I was thinking he was supposed to play this to start.
Oh,
not,
yeah.
You know what I mean? So that's why I was a little confused there too. So yeah,
it seems like the raise re-raise.
Yeah, I never would have played this hand in the first start. But then I think at the end, you probably were making the right call there, even though you got extremely lucky. Yeah, that's interesting. And I've never seen the column either. So if somebody finds it or somebody knows the math on it and wants to send it in, we'll certainly feature it on the show at some point. So, okay, find yourself in a situation at your favorite poker room or home game and not sure what the proper ruling should have been. Email us at podcast@annieupmagazine.com, and we'll have Annie Up Poker Tour Tournament Director Sam Minutello tell you how he would have ruled. This week's sponsor is Smapsoft, creator of the Chinese 13-card poker app for Apple products. Download the app today by visiting the iTunes Store. And I have to say that app helped me a lot when I was like on the plane flying like 8 hours to Italy, and you know, and like holed up in like train stations waiting for my train and stuff. I played a lot of that app, man. It's a real good app. I really enjoy it. So
yeah, it's interesting. Is we're gonna have our first Chinese tournament in the history of Thunder Valley here on Friday. It's open face, so it's a little different than Chinese, but this is really a market that hasn't had a lot of Chinese. And I was telling the poker manager here that, I mean, just because no one's spreading Chinese here doing a tournament, I guarantee you 100 people are playing it on their phones.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is one of our Annie Up winners from Minnesota was out here, and I was playing with him the other night. And, he's one of these guys that sits there with his iPad and plays Chinese while he's playing the tournament. Right.
Yeah.
And, he's like, God, so many people are coming up to me going, what's that? So it's possible that we might be in the only area of the world where they don't really know about Chinese poker. So we might have to get our good friends at Smapsoft to, you know, parachute in some apps here.
Yeah, really. So this comes from Mike Barnes from British Columbia. He says, this comes from a home game with many inexperienced players. Pre-flop, I shove with A6, and it folds around to the big blind, who snap calls and tables ace-ace. I table my hand, and the rest of the table gets a laugh at my expense. At that point, we realized the dealer, one of the beginners, grabbed the muck and slapped it on top of the deck, and then was reaching for the tabled hands. I told her to stop, and she pulled back, looking confused. The muck had been put onto the deck, and my opponent mucked his hand and said, "Miss deal." What would have a casino done if the deck was fouled after an all-in and a call pre-flop? By the way, before we even say Sam's answer, I gotta say, I want his friend in every home game I ever play in.
Oh my gosh! Yeah.
What a great guy. or girl. Okay, I didn't say lady or whatever. I mean, but right. I mean that's just incredible.
Yeah, totally mucking his ace ace because of this deal.
Yeah, he mucked his ace ace. He's up against A6, totally crushing him, and he's like, "Ah, Miss Deal. Ah, Miss Deal. You're about to knock somebody out in a home game or make a ton of money. What are you doing?" But that's the kind of people you want to be friends with. So
yeah, I'm gonna go on a limb and say this is the kind of guy that I want to punch because he's probably just too nice.
He's too nice,
you know.
You want to set the ball in motion for him to turn evil.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, there's no way. No one is this nice.
That was crazy.
Maybe he or she is. But, all right. Sam says, what I would have done is asked to deal with the muck cards were directly on top of the deck, and they were 100% positive about this. I would then inform the table they were going to simply remove the muck cards from the top of the deck and proceed on with the hand. I always try to gain as much information about the situation at hand and make the fairest ruling for that situation. I'm never going to declare a missed deal after an all-in and a call has occurred. The hand would have been completed, and the best hand upon completion would win the pot.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good thing. We get a couple other – I mean, we've got a ton of call of floors backed up. So if folks have sent them in, don't worry. We're going to get them on eventually. There's just – people love this feature, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of them are about killing hands or dead hands. And, you know, one of Sam's mantras now is, you know, poker players need to quit winning on technicalities.
Yes.
With the best hand. And this is obviously a little different. This isn't a technicality. I mean, the guy with the best hand actually wanted to muck his hand to call off his deal. But yeah, once you have significant action like this, you got to find a way to play the hand out. There's no such thing as a redo or do-over. You know, like you're playing kickball when you're 4 years old. You know, you got to do the best thing you can. So he's right. If you're able to, you know, close to 100% or 100% get back to the deck, then yeah, absolutely. It has nothing to do with the fact that those cards were diseased because they're mucked. You're buying the right card, you're turning them over, and if for some reason you can't figure that out, then you know probably the next scenario is just shuffling the deck and still going out. But the last, I mean, you're never going to misdeal when you have an all-in and take your money back. Just, no. So if you're at home and you're wondering what's going on and someone says misdeal when there's been action, let's start to do over, say stop, no way, you never do that. We got to figure out the best solution that doesn't involve that, and that's going to solve your problem.
Right, and I don't want to extend the show any longer than I need to, but really quickly, I remember that was the crux of the worst beat in the history of poker that we ever heard of. TJ Cloutier one, where the guy had pocket tens, and all the tens were mucked, but then the person put the muck on top of, and the only way the pocket tens could have beaten the pocket kings or whatever it was is to have one of those tens back in the deck to be able to come out on the flop, but there was no way they would have been because everyone folded their tens. But then the dealer made a mistake and put the muck on top of the deck, and they had to shuffle the deck, and that, sure enough, the 10 comes on the flop, which couldn't possibly have come out had he not put the muck on the deck, and they had to reshuffle. So that was what they did at that moment, was they reshuffled all the cards, and the guy gets to hit his 10, even though both 10s were folded. So
yeah, and that solution is not a fair solution, but it's the most fair solution.
Yeah, it's the only one that's remaining. Yeah, exactly.
You know, I go back and forth with some of our listeners on Sam's rulings or what I think I would do, and they're like, "Well, that's not fair." And I'm like, "You're right, it's not." But we're in a situation where nothing is going to be perfect here, so we're just coming up with the most perfect solution we can. And if folks can figure that out and try to figure it out, then and live with it, then their home games are going to be a lot easier, I think.
Well, after a week's delay, we get to finally complete our O'Malley's move. It's been a couple weeks, so let's refresh our memories with part one.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we're seated at a $1, $2 PLO8 game. This table is chock full of calling stations, so generally, we like to use our better post-flop play to our advantage. The table is seven-handed. We've already had to rebuy once, and we now sit with 300, down 200 for the day. The under-the-gun calls, MP calls, hijack folds, cutoff calls, and we're on the button with the ace of spades, ace of diamonds, nine of diamonds, seven of spades. We've got double-suited aces, and although we don't have a very strong low draw, we're going to try to thin the herd a bit. We make it $20 to go. Small blind folds, big blind folds, under-the-gun calls, MP calls, cutoff folds, and we're going to the flop with $63 in the pot, and it's a good one. The ace of clubs, 10 of clubs, 6 of hearts falls. The under-the-gun leads out for $30, and the MP folds. This player is a bit of a wild card. He doesn't know much about the game, is a converted hold'em player, and likes to play lots of hands. He started the hand with $250. We want to make him pay to see any more cards. We raise the bet to $75. The under-the-gun thinks for a short time before calling. The turn is the 4 of clubs. This time the under-the-gun checks. This card sucks. It completes the flush draw, and any Yahoo hanging around with Trey Deuce now has half of our pot. We elect to exercise some caution and pot control, and we check. The river is the Jack of Hearts. Our opponent wastes little time in shoving. So if we call and lose, we're down to $50. What's the play?
All right, I'm fresh off of tanking the Limit Omaha 8 tournament yesterday, so I'm an exact expert on this. Wasn't pot limit, but same game, right?
Yeah.
So I'm always folding, almost always folding here. I mean, we have top set, no low. The board has flush, straight, and low possibilities.
Yeah.
So the two axioms of split pot games are to have the nuts and play for the whole pot, and we're woefully deficient in both here. I would say my only pause is that the player is described as someone new to the game, and my experience is newbies really struggle adjusting to the complexity of PLO8. From the relative simplicity of no-limit hold'em, especially in misreading pot control turn checks. But even with that considered, I just don't see the proper reward for the risk here. I'm folded.
Me too. I'm sorry to be so short, but yeah, a fold is fine with just a set. And even if it's top set, like you said, that board is so wet, you know, it could be a huge pool for Shamu. And so, plus, if he doesn't know what he's doing, it seems to me that he's confident to bet all of his money like that. And so if you're confident and you bet that much money, generally beginners will have something there. Now, of course, it is 08, so he could be just going with the low and understand that facet of the game, which would suck, and it's possible. But, you know, it doesn't matter. What matters is that all we have is a set here, and it's you know, we don't need to lose any more money. If the guy's that much of a beginner, he can take his money on another hand, so I would just move on to the next hand.
But, you know, that's a good point. We talk about when you – to bring Joe Navarro into this, you know, he's talking about you're getting tells, right?
Yeah.
Off of people. If someone doesn't know that they don't have a good hand, but they're doing all the tells that tell you they have a good hand, doesn't mean they have a good hand. It just means that they think they have a good hand.
That's
right?
True, too. That's true.
And that's the same thing here. I mean, we were playing in a player in the horse tournament this weekend. I talked with the guy that ended up chopping it, who was at my table the entire time. And there's another player that was at our table all the time, and that player was part of the chop. And I'm like, I can't believe she was still at the table. And it was just because, I mean, she wasn't skilled at it, but there's so much forgiveness in the split pot games that even if you're wrong on your high, you could still get the low. And that's the case here. We have no low. So let's say even this person was confident with their high and it's a weak high, they could have a low and take half the pot and maybe not even know what they have in their hand. They could have a, you know, a baby flush or something.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The only thing that gives me pause from that point of view is that it's PLO and a guy bet everything he has. And usually beginners don't want to go broke and bet that kind of money not knowing something. So I feel like he's got something, but the problem is if it's the high side, we're screwed. If it's the low side, okay, we got duped. So I just don't like our situation and I'm folding. So All right, here we go. Here's part two.
Hello again. There's just too much danger out there for us to call here. Even though we've already invested a third of our stack, I don't see this as a good spot to risk anymore. He seems extremely confident in his hand and has since the turn. Fortunately, we're on friendly terms with this player, so if we fold, he probably won't keep us guessing as to what he has. We elect to fold, only showing our aces. Our opponent smiles and picks out two cards to show us. Trey deuce, suited and clubs. Ugh. But I'm glad we got away from it. Until next time, I am Malcolm O'Malley saying, don't get married to aces, especially in PLO 8. I hope to see you on the felt.
Yep.
Yep.
Sorry to be so short, but yep.
Reason number 435 that this game sucks or is brilliant. I don't know which one it is yet. I feel like it sucks, but I can't really be that way because I love Stud 8, and it's the same kind of thinking behind it where you could be pushing the low the whole way and getting people out. So, yeah, I don't know. I never get this game anymore. I just don't like it.
I'm going to say this is no surprise to you or anybody listening. I'm going to err on the side of brilliant here.
Yeah, I know.
Because this is when I'm teaching the OMA classes on our ship. I mean, this is one of the reasons I like this game is because your decisions – there are times your decisions are made for you, and that almost never happens in Hold'em, right?
Yeah.
And holding me, I'm like, oh, is this guy bluffing me or not? I mean, I got this pair. I mean, especially in Omaha split pot games, I mean, you go back and you look at this board just like we analyzed it, and it doesn't matter. You throw in the whole wild card of whether this player that we're playing against knows what he or she is doing. It doesn't matter because you're just doing the cards and know that it just doesn't make sense to make the call at all. And you don't get that kind of clarity in Hold'em, I think. So that's why it's brilliant.
That's why it sucks.
All right, it's time for Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast@anteupmagazine.com. This week's sponsor is TournamentButton.com, which offers a variety of home dealer buttons with timers built right into them. You can even customize them with your own photo or logo. Ask about the AnteUp logo version and use code AnteUp for free shipping. And this week comes from Adam from Pittsburgh.
Cool.
And says he's been listening to our podcast for about a year and just played poker for money for the first time yesterday.
Whoa.
Pretty much my entire poker education comes from listening to AnteUp, so God help me.
No.
I love that line so much I put it on Facebook.
Man.
He says, this is the second hand I ever showed Dan. All right, so a complete newbie here, so we're going to go easy on him.
Yep.
Maybe we don't have to. Maybe he played this perfectly and we don't have to go easy on him.
That's right? True, too.
Playing 1-3, no limit, hold'em at a casino. He bought him for the minimum $100. The max of the table is 200, and he's currently at 122.
Nice job.
So ran it up to 122. So he doesn't even know the lingo yet.
I know he's got to learn the lingo, but that's good, though. That's good. He worked it up, and bought it for the minimum. That's understandable. You know, your first time out, and if it was 1-300, you might be like at a disadvantage. When it's 1-2, you know, you're not that much of a disadvantage. I don't mind at all buying in for the minimum there, just to get, you know, it's the first time he's playing. Why risk 200 when you want to learn? So
yeah, I would argue if I'm a newbie that even buying the minimum in a 1-3 is not a mistake. It's probably the proper play because it makes your decisions easier for you.
Yeah, exactly.
And once you get a little bit more skill, then yeah, you need those extra bullets so you don't get pushed around. But I think you can use that to your advantage. Even if it's a 1-2 no max buy-in, I mean, might as well buy in for the minimum and until you get your feet wet.
Yeah.
All right. So he says, let's see. We got a couple folds, a middle position player limps, and we're in the cutoff with ace of diamonds and king of clubs. So one limper and we're in the cutoff.
I like to raise here. You know, in our 1-3 games on the ship, an open raise is usually like 10, sometimes 12. If you're Scott Long, it's 25.
And for Chris Cassandra, your raises after that are 55.
Yeah, 55, that's right. And it worked, too, because I didn't want to bust anybody, but I wanted to take down the money. So here we go. I would make it probably 15-ish, because, like I said, I think 10 is probably a decent to 12 is decent raise without somebody in the pot already. Sure. But we have someone in the pot limping along, so maybe 15.
I think 15 is perfect. I normally do 10, and then I add a 5 for every person, and it's probably not ideal, but at least it's consistent.
Yeah, that's good enough.
All right, so he says, at this point, I've only been at the table for a few hands. I can tell the button is a tight player with a stack around $100. The guys in the blind seem generally loose passive with stacks around 150 or 200. The limper is a young guy who seems at least slightly drunk. Awesome. Chewing tobacco and carrying on with the two young guys to his right. He has a stack of at least 1,000 and seems to be loose aggressive. I'm clearly the tightest player at the table, but I doubt the rest of the table knows it yet.
Right.
That's probably true. You've only been there two hands, so
you've
got to remember that it's not what you think you are, it's what they think you are.
Right, exactly.
All right, well, he goes ahead and raises to 15.
Yay!
He says 12 to 18 seems typical at this table. The button folds, blinds call, and as does the limper.
Yeah, okay. So that's good. You got the button out of the way. So we're the button. We're last to act. We got position now. That's really good. The blinds call, which is kind of surprising. Both blinds calling is kind of surprising. I mean,
yeah, you don't normally see that with a decent size raise.
Yep. And middle position call. So there's some good money in the pot. You're already looking at like $60. So, all right, here we go.
All right, the flop is the king of spades, nine of clubs, five of spades. And the original limper checks to us. It's checked around to us.
Checked around. Okay. All right, so here's the deal. If you look at that board, it's kind of wet. You know, it's got two spades. It's got straight draws both ways. I mean, people could easily be calling with 7-8 or with jack-10. So there may be gut shots, but they're still, you know, in your mind, if there's two gut shots out there, that means it's open-ended. That means you can literally be losing the 8 outs plus the spades. So you're going to want to bet, and you're going to want to bet probably like a little more than half this pot, I would think, to try to get out some people. I mean, you wouldn't mind one caller because you got top pair, top kicker.
Sure,
But, you know, you're going to want to, you know, protect your hand. So, I don't know. Let's see. I said there's about 60 in this pot, right? 4 times 15.
There has to be, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think I would bet like 40 or 45 here. I don't think any less than that, and these guys are going to call if they're drawing. You know, or at least if they do, you're not making it a mistake for them to call. So I feel like 40, 45.
Yeah, really, like, I would encourage our listeners to go back. I think it was last issue, maybe it was 2 issues ago. One of our new columnists, Natasha Barber, wrote a really good column on bet sizing, I thought. And because one of the things you like to do with your bet sizing is bet the same so people can't get a read on your betting tells, right?
Right.
Which I'm a big proponent of, and she actually took that step further and makes her bets based on the texture of the board rather than her holdings. And when it's a wet board like it is here, then she generally bets 2/3, 3/4 of the pot, which makes sense in general, and it doesn't matter what your holdings are, whether, you know, if you flop a set or you're bluffing. So obviously here we're right in the middle of that, and I definitely like 40 sounds perfect to me.
Yeah, yeah, because if there's 60, then what, 45 is two-thirds, so you're about, 45 is about two-thirds, so 40, 45 I think is the right number.
Yeah, I remember they probably took $5 out for the rake already too, probably.
So. Yeah, yeah, they probably took rake out. So yeah, so 40 sounds good then.
All right, so our hero, says it's just me. Our reason I need to make a continuation bet around half the pot to price out anyone on a flush draw. I bet $30, the blinds fold, and the original limper calls.
Well, that's good. So we're heads up now with top pair, top kicker. We got to be wary of the spades, but even if another spade comes, you know, the odds of him having two spades and not raising you there, you know, he may, you know, not believe you or whatever. So don't always assume that the third spade gets there that you're screwed either. So, but it's good now. Your head's up and you've done your job. I'm surprised 30 did that. I thought if somebody's drawing, they might have called for 30, though. That doesn't seem like enough to me. But that still, it worked, so good for you.
Yeah, and I mean, he ended up getting the desired effect, which is heads up for $10 less than we would have. So.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
All right, the turn is the tray of spades. So our board now is king of spades, nine of clubs, five of spades, tray of spades. So unfortunately, that spade does get there, as you mentioned. But the limper checks.
Okay, well, sometimes I would check back here. But I'm giving somebody with a random spade a free shot at making that flush to beat me, and I don't know if I want to do that. So, you know, for pot control, sometimes I would check back here. But this is kind of dangerous, because now another straight draw gets there. If he's got some ace-4 random whatever, but he wouldn't have called. You know, he might have had something like ace-9, you know, and thought that his nines might have been good, you know, or whatever. So, I think I'm going to bet. So we bet 30, so it was 60. It was like 120 in the pot. Jeez. He only has 90 left, you know.
Yep.
I don't know. Maybe check behind. I don't know. I'm not scared of those spades yet, you know. But if a fourth spade comes, then you're like, all right, what do I do? Jeez. I think I'm betting. I know. I feel like in this hand, I need to bet here. I really do. I feel like, what was he calling with? Could he have like a backdoor spade in his hand that now he's picked up a draw and he's got a pair? Maybe he has a weaker king than me, because what's he calling with if, you know, if he checks now? Why would he check now? He would think, for me betting and protecting, he would think I had a hand, so he'd want to bet into me now, maybe, or check, you know. I don't know. There's so many ways you can go on this with the way the villain could be thinking. I don't know. In my gut, I feel like I need to bet here, maybe because hand of the week, I don't know. but I feel like I need to bet, I don't know, maybe 50? 120? See, that's not even... It feels like if you're going to bet, you're going to shove, but that it seems like it could be such a huge mistake to shove here, because you only have 90 left. You're betting more than 50% of your stack. You know, by betting 50. Maybe you do shove. Maybe you just shove. I feel bad about shoving, though, if you're wrong. You know, you try to protect your hand, you got a caller, and then a couple of draws got there. Or, well, at least one draw got there. God, I feel like this is so much pressure for... He's a beginner, too, so I don't want to mislead him.
Yeah, I think...
Okay, go ahead. No, you go ahead. I'm not going, you go.
Well, I would say there is an optimal way to play this hand, and then there's an optimal way for a beginner to play this hand. So, I mean, we can actually analyze this hand twice if we wanted to, but I'm going to say, since we're talking about a beginner here, I'm going to err on the side of caution here and check behind. Because, again, I'm playing the mind games. His first time in a casino, right? 1-3, I'm sure this $100 means the world to him, right? No matter how much money he has, it means the world to him because it's his first time playing
right.
In a live casino, right? So the last thing you want to do is shove here, be wrong, and then just to get discouraged and not come back, or take months to come back, right? Now, obviously, if you check behind here and then you let the guy peel off that fourth spade that beats you, it's the same thing. But I would rather err on the side of caution here. I mean, I think I would like to control the pot here. I'm probably going to get this all in on the river if the guy shoves. I mean, but I would rather just check behind. And then the other thing, the reason I like to check behind here too, is because, again, I like to be consistent in my action. So I'm going to do the same thing if, let's say, I made that bet on the flop and now I hit my spades. I also like to check behind because now it makes it sound like I don't have the clubs and I can induce that spade. Or, I mean, that bluff on the river.
Right, you do this.
So as long as I'm consistent with it, then I'm going to win some hands with it. I'm going to lose some hands with it. Hopefully, I'm going to win more chips than I lose. That's the whole idea. But I'm going to be consistent with it, so I'm not even trying to talk myself into it here. I just like to check behind, and then we'll see what happens on the river. I mean, again, I mean, we have so many chips left anyhow. The top pair here in a 1-3 game, I'm probably going to call whatever the bet is in the end, and if I'm done, boom. That's why you buy in for the minimum, so you can put another bullet on the table if you want.
Okay, a couple more things I want to say real quick. One, I forgot about the race preflop, so that's 45 off of his 122-ish. So he's only got like 70-something.
Right.
So now I'm thinking you can't even bet 50. You have to shove or not. The other thing I'm going to say...
Exactly.
Yeah, I forgot about that. I was thinking he had 90 because it was just a 30. I forgot. So, okay, so he probably should shove here. And the reason why I say that, I know what you were saying. I'm going to say the exact opposite of for a beginner. in tournaments or in cash games, you don't want to get outplayed by players who are better than you. So you want to play big pots with them.
True.
Because they don't want to, if they're a good player or a decent player, or they've been around for a while, they don't want to play big pots with somebody who doesn't know what they're doing because they don't know what you have. You could have something crazy great or nothing, and it's like a guessing game with them, and take skill out of it. Like when you're in a tournament and you're shoving with any hand preflop, you're taking the guessing out, and you can't get outplayed when you do that. You're just shoving. So in this case, I feel like if you check behind, if you had a spade in your hand and you raised like we did preflop and we continuation bet on this flop, and we had a spade in our hand, I don't think we check again. Because now we've got, obviously we had decent cards in our hand to start.
Right.
And then we're saying we've hit some of this. So now we got to keep up the story. If you had a spade in your hand, you would have bet again. If you didn't, you would check behind. So if a spade comes on the river, now he can try to steal it from us because he's clearly thinking, if you had a spade in your hand with four spades, you'd bet here. Now I know we're a beginner, but he doesn't know we're a beginner. So
right.
I think we need to shove.
Well, the other thing, too, the shove does, and it's probably, again, it goes back to what I said, that there's an optimal play and a beginner, I think. The shove here takes away the ability for somebody to bluff you off this hand.
Yes.
And once all your chips are in here now, I mean, if he's on the come now with the spade now you put him to a test, and he's got to decide whether it's worth it or not. Or if you check here, then he's got the ability to shove on the river and put you to a test. But when you have no chips left, you know, he can't bluff you off the hand. He's got to beat you with cards.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So there are some positives to shoving here. I feel like it's the right play. And if you're wrong and the guy's got a flush, well, you're screwed. But if he's got a spade, then at least you're protecting your hand, and you're going to have to hit the spade to beat you or some other pair or something, a two pair or something. But it feels like, to me, the right move now is just to shove.
Yeah, and again, this is why I like buying in light as a beginner, because, I mean, really, you can't make a mistake here, I don't think. Yeah, you shove here and he doesn't have it, and you win the pot. You shove here, he does have it, and you've only committed 100 at this time, so you put another 100 on the table and do a fresh start.
Yeah,
it's not optimal for everyone, but when you're a beginner, it gives you that peace of mind that, you know, the decision's a little easier now. I mean, if we were sitting here with 500 right now and our opponent had 1,000, it'd be a much different decision, right?
Yep. Yeah.
All right. So let's see. Where are we? All right, so the limper checked, and we check behind. He says, I'm not sure if this was the right move, but my reasoning was that I wouldn't have enough to make a reasonable river bet if I bet anything here. I don't want to appear worried about a flush, but I'm hoping my check could come off as sneaky rather than timid.
Okay.
Which I think we kind of talked about.
Yeah, we kind of talked about that, yeah.
You only have one bet left anyhow, so it's not like you have a reasonable river bet left here. I mean, either you're shoving or not here, so it's just a matter of whether you put it on the turn or not.
Yeah.
All right, well, the river is the six of spades, so our final board is king of spades, nine of clubs, five of spades, tray of spades, six of spades, so the exact thing we hoped didn't happen. And our opponent slides out one of his tall stacks of high society, and that's put me in for $77. Six back smugly and looks me in the face.
See, now this is what I'm talking about. The other thing, too, is it couldn't have been any worse of a spade, because now, like, 7-8 gets there. You know what I mean? Like, straights get there, too, on top of it. So if he knows you don't have a spade, but the straight's probably strong enough to make him confident to bet. You know, and the other thing, too, is that if he took the line of thinking I was thinking of earlier, not knowing that you're a beginner, he thinks you're savvy, and you check behind, then he's probably thinking, okay, if you had a spade, you would have bet there because you have something and a spade redraw. Since you didn't bet again, you don't have a spade, so I'm going to try to bluff you off this hand. That's what it feels like, because why wouldn't he have bet earlier? You know, if he had the flush draw, you know, he might have bet it. And if not, then it feels like he could be stealing this from you. So I don't know if I can make, I don't know if I have the confidence to call here, but I think a call is right. I think this guy is trying to bluff you off this hand. I think by that check and the spade coming, he's going to represent this flush. Right. It feels a lot like that. But in the moment, I don't know if I can make the call. I don't know if I can pull the trigger on that. Probably could, because it's only 77. I play for a lot more money than that when I play. So for me, I would have made the call. But for a beginner, it's a difficult call to make because you only sat down with 100, and now it's only $23 less than what you started playing with, not what you had to start at hand. So you know, you could easily just fold and say, I'll make that 23 back like I made the 22 when I started, and I'll be right back to where I was, and do I really need to make this call here? But it feels like it's the right move. It feels like there's enough money out there that this guy was just representing something. He probably had an inferior hand, got into trouble, and picked up on something on us and call and made that shove to push us off the hand. So I feel like, and you know, there's something else too that we don't know. Adam could have been putting out some sort of tells that showed that he was a beginner to this guy. You know, you don't know that. You don't know what's going on at this table. He may have picked up on that, even though it's hand two. There could have been a way that he was calling bets or making bets or something that would have given this guy's an amateur. Maybe I can get away with bluffing him, you know. So take all that into consideration and then make the call, I think.
Sure. All right, so O'Hara says, it's fishy to me that he played passively up to this point and then made a huge bet on the river. I think if he had an overpair or a set, he would have raised preflop given his aggressive style. He clearly wants me to fold his bet. Because of that, I can't put him on the nut flush, in which case he would have bet for value. The same reason, I don't think he's trying to represent the nut flush, which I think would be the correct move if he had a small flush and was worried I had something like second nut flush, or if he had a 7-8 and was worried I had any flush. There'd be some sort of reverse psychology going on, but I think if he was smart enough for that, he wouldn't be drunk at the table. It seems like he's betting because it's the only way he can win the hand, and he didn't really think about how to size it correctly. Also, it's intentionally intimidating body language would be consistent with a weak holding. Look at that, Joe Navarro.
Yeah.
He says, like, I'm really nervous, but I think the right move is to call, so I do. Uh-oh. At showdown, the player says, expletive deleted. I don't have a spade, do you? I say nothing. He shows 7-9 of diamonds, so my top pair holds up.
Wow.
The tight player on the button tells me, nice hand, which is what I would say to encourage someone to hit that one on a bad decision. So then I'm thinking I misplayed it.
No.
I'm pretty sure my play was correct up the turn, although I'm not positive about bet sizing. I don't know if I made the correct moves on the turn and river. It was really hard to call a four spades and a straight draw on the board, and I wonder if that might have been a bad move in the long run.
Well, again, it's hard to really so many things can contribute to different plays here. If you had more money, you might have played it differently. That's another reason for setting down with the maximum, because then you don't have to be hindered by the amount of chips in front of you. I mean, the proper bet, you know, earlier should have been 40-ish, what we think is proper. Right. The proper bet later, you probably should have bet that turn. And if you had 222 to start the hand, then you would have had 177 left, and you wouldn't have been thinking, okay, I'm betting more than half my stack here, I might as well just shove. No, you could have maybe bet him off the hand on the turn, because you would have protected your hand again, instead of being nervous and checking behind because you only have 77 left to put on the river. So there are reasons why you could have played this hand differently. Money would have been one of them. So I think that you played okay. I think it's a great call. It's a tough call to make, and you made it. You put it together. Some of the things that you said, like when he says the huge bet on the river, why would he have done that? Now, to me, yeah, to bluff, that's what you're going to do. But also, he could also say, this guy could have, you know, the queen of spades in his hand, and I have the ace of spades. Let me, you know, make a huge bet so he thinks I'm bluffing, and then he calls. There are a lot of people who just can't let you get away with what they just don't want to be bluffed. And so they bet the maximum amount to make you think that they're bluffing, and then you call and he turns over the ace of spades. So,
right. It's all part of the psychology.
Yeah.
I mean, I was in a tournament 2 nights ago where someone made a huge bet on the river with a nut flush and got somebody to call because they thought in their mind that if he had the nut flush, why would you bet that much? Because you're trying to value bet. And his reverse psychology, he knew that player well enough to know that, or making that big bet, that he was going to think it was a bluff and induce him to call rather than, you know, a value bet where he might have folded. I mean, that's what's so crazy about this game.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. But I tell you what, for your first time out, you've made a lot of money, and you got to the right decision. Whether you went there the right way or not, you made what you thought were the right. And the thing about it is you're thinking about it, and that's what's important. And right. You're starting to analyze things and put people on ranges and stuff, and that's really important. So your first time out, you won money, and you made some good calls too, which a lot of people can go months, their whole careers sometimes, without making good calls. So you're on your way. So I and plus now you're part of the show, so that's got to be good too. All right, thanks, Adam. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.